This is the handheld.
That is.
All right, we're running a little ahead of schedule, but we're just going to keep rolling. It is my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Rachel Steinholt. She works as an assistant federal public defender in Fargo, North Dakota, with a focus on appeals and retroactive projects. Before joining the federal public defenders, Rachel worked at human rights organizations in Minneapolis and India, a legal aid clinic in Philadelphia, and an international criminal tribunal in the Netherlands. Today, Rachel will be discussing the Fourth Amendment implications of mandatory breath and blood tests in drunk driving investigations through the lens of the 2016 case Birchfield v. North Dakota. On a personal note, Rachel was also a wonderful mentor to me after I had just finished my first year of law school, and it is just wonderful to see you again. Thank you for coming out.
I paid Alex to say that, so remember to circle back at the end of this so I can give you your $20. Hi, I'm Rachel Steinholt. Like Alex said, I'm an assistant federal public defender in Fargo, North Dakota. I should thank UND for inviting me to do this, pulling me out from behind the computer screen, as most of us appellate writers like to spend our time. Also wanted to thank UND for this opportunity, because Birchfield, you will soon find out, Birchfield versus North Dakota is about drunk driving. That's not normally, that doesn't come across in my work as a federal public defender. So it was an opportunity to venture into a kind of new area of law for me to learn about. So that was exciting. And so, okay, let's get started. So the case is Birchfield versus North Dakota. That case was decided by the Supreme Court in 2016. Let's start off with a little bit of history. So my slides aren't going to rival Jim's, the clip art from Jim's PowerPoint presentation, but I tried. So let's start with a little history on drunk driving laws. Drunk driving has been a problem since cars have been around. So so a brief overview is how that area of law has developed over the years. In the 1930s, when Prohibition ended, there was an increase in drunk driving, not surprisingly. And that's when you first saw, around that time, they were setting committees up to solve the problem, and they first got the concept of the blood alcohol content level. They set that at 0.15, and that was a rebuttable presumption. So, so if somebody was determined to have that blood alcohol level, they weren't automatically convicted. It was they could rebut that. Over time, states have moved away from that and have since lowered it to 0.10. Some states are 0.08. And it has become per se illegal. It's no longer a rebuttable presumption. So that's a little background on that. A little bit further background is the idea of these implied consent laws. So today, all 50 states have adopted implied consent laws, and what those are, in essence, is if you want to drive on the road, you, as a condition of being able to drive on the road, you are supposed to adhere to certain standards. One of them is not to drink and drive. So, normally the what states have done is that there's certain ways to regulate this, right? So on the top there, we have testing. So to test blood alcohol, there's normally a blood test. There's also a breath test. So states, and North Dakota specifically, didn't like this idea of forcible testing to force people to give blood tests, and they don't want to avoid the violent confrontations that those could possibly entail. And they've made the testing voluntary. So they've asked them to please consent to do this. And if they don't, there are penalties for refusal. That has primarily been through administrative remedies. So, namely, we're going to revoke your license, which is a privilege to drive on the road. It's not your constitutional right to be able to drive on the road. And so, normally, that has been, if you refuse to consent to one of those two tests, then they say, that's great, give us your license. So, what North Dakota did in 2013, and Minnesota had done several decades prior, is my understanding, is that not only did they enforce the administrative remedies, but they had added criminal prosecution. So not only if you refuse is your license going to be revoked, but you could also face jail time, and you could be criminally punished for refusal. So, which, when you look at the numbers, there had been a considerable decrease in drunk driving deaths had gone down proportionately over the years because of higher regulation of first the refusal or first the revocation of taking back people's licenses, and then also in Minnesota with the threat of criminal prosecution. So North Dakota adopts that in 2013, and then it culminates in three cases that are consolidated for Supreme Court review. So the namesake of the case is Birchfield. It's a North Dakota case. That gentleman was given a roadside breath test, which, what I've learned, only produces a preliminary result. It's not admissible in court normally. That's done at a later, they actually bring folks into the station to do a more accurate breath test later on. That is an important fact that will come in later in the presentation. So Birchfield does this preliminary test, and then it blows high in the 0.25 range, but then he refuses to permit the blood test. So he gets convicted of a criminal offense, and then he argued that the Fourth Amendment prohibited criminalizing his refusal to submit to this test. We have Bernard out of Minnesota, and Bernard refuses to even do the breath test. So at the Supreme Court and throughout the appellate process, he argued that that just warrantless breath tests violate the Fourth Amendment. And then I'm not exactly sure. Bailand is our third case that was consolidated for the Supreme Court case, and that also came out of North Dakota. And he agreed to have his blood drawn, and that was analyzed, and he was convicted of a drunk driving offense. But he argued that his consent was coerced because he was told that refusal is a crime, and so that consent shouldn't count. And so the Supreme Court decided to take all three of these very, related cases to decide this issue once and for all. So I had the opportunity to listen to the oral argument, very interesting argument to listen to. It had started off with a couple of the justices framing the argument as, should this be something that when people are signing up for their driver's license, should we have them, should we include a consent that they have to sign? That says you agree that you will submit to these types of tests. So that the argument starts off a lot of questions along that line, and then it shifts to reframing the question as this is a search by taking somebody's breath test or blood test, so this should be analyzed under our search doctrine, and so doing this is a search, and it's a warrantless search. These officers don't have a warrant to do this. So we know that the Fourth Amendment doesn't prohibit all searches, just unreasonable searches. So since these officers aren't doing this with a warrant, we have to see if this falls under one of the warrant exceptions. So they looked at these two types of tests, blood tests and breath tests. And so the first doctrine that they look under is exigency. And that one, based off of case law, besides one justice, Justice Thomas was, you'll see later on, he was all on board on this should all be exigent circumstances, and that's all we need. So both of these should be admissible. And the argument for exigency is that blood alcohol diminishes, the alcohol in your blood diminishes over time, and you metabolize it, and so it's exigent to get the test because you won't have the evidence, it goes away. They determined by looking at their case law that they had actually looked at the natural dissipation of alcohol from the bloodstream and decided in McNeely that that does not always, as a categorical rule, that does not always constitute exigency, which justifies warrantless samples. So they said, we already looked at that, and we've already kind of decided that issue. And Schmerber, which was decided after that, agreed and said that exigency is really a case-specific. It's not a categorical type of rule. It's case-specific. So exigency is not the doctrine that this falls under, and that captures most of the justices except for, like I said, Justice Thomas, who wrote exigency until the very end. So the rest of the conversation shifts to the search incident to arrest doctrine, which is another complicated doctrine that has developed throughout time. The Supreme Court has grappled with this area throughout the years. The idea behind that is there's this officer safety and evidence destruction, right? So when somebody's arresting an individual, then where we have landed is that the officer, for their own safety, for officer safety, is allowed to pat down the individual and also the area immediately surrounding them. So so they started looking at these tests, the blood and breath tests, as under the search incident to arrest doctrine, where primarily there's a balance. What the majority found is that, based off the Riley case in 2014, is that how we're going to look at this in assessing blood and breath tests is we're going to look at weighing the legitimate government interest that they have in getting drunk drivers off the road and making sure that the roads are safe for everybody versus an individual's privacy rights to their information and their body. So that's where the majority decided to focus their decision-making on. So when we look at breath tests, so with breath tests, they found that these are your privacy interest in your breath is minimal. So everybody's constantly exhaling. You guys are wearing masks. So it's, we are all constantly exhaling breath at all times. It's not something that we have to do. It's natural. It's painless to do the breath test. You, shoot through a straw into this little device. So it doesn't reveal much about you. Like a blood test can reveal, a lot more personal information. Breath doesn't. It really is, your blood alcohol content and maybe what you ate for dinner, but nothing else. And it's not embarrassing to do a breath test. So they were looking at the breath test, and it's relatively quick, even though I did mention before that you do actually have to go down to the, as it currently sits, you go down to the station and they perform the court admissible one there. But all things considered, they say, legitimate government interest to get drunk drivers off the road. This relatively easy, painless breath test. That's minimally intrusive. We are leaning towards and ultimately deciding to do a categorical warrantless exception by allowing breath tests. When they look at blood, they land differently. So you're not constantly shedding blood, or you shouldn't be. So that is different from breath, where you're, you know, constantly breathing. So there's pain associated with retrieving the blood. That sample can be preserved, and they can use it for DNA analysis later on, and it reveals certainly a lot more about you than breath does. So for a number of reasons, they felt that blood test is much more of an intrusive infringement on your personal privacy rights, and thus there's the line between the two. So what the majority lands on is that they are going to permit a categorical exception to the warrant for breath tests, but under the search incident to arrest doctrine. And then for blood tests, they say, oh, we're not doing a categorical exception. This is going to still be a case-by-case basis. We're hoping that you opt for the, it's more of a last resort. So go with the breath test if you can, but it sort of falls back under the exigency where it's a case-specific analysis where you're looking at the facts specifically. So that's where the majority lands. So I have Justice Sotomayor up here because, and she did, she was very interesting to listen to at the oral argument, if anybody gets the opportunity to do this. I know Justice Sutton already gave you guys homework, so if you're really bored, you could listen to this. And she was actually pretty funny on this. But so she takes issue with this. So she actually ends up writing, she concurs in part and she dissents in part. And so she says that there should be a search warrant. You should get a search warrant every single time that you're going to do. She agrees with blocking the blood test, right? And then she says, a breath test, you should get a search warrant for a breath test as well. And so the majority addresses that argument. And they say Justice Sotomayor says that, this whole warrantless exception proposition is we should use this rarely. That shouldn't be the norm. And the majority says that her understanding of that, of categorical approach versus case-by-case basis, is misunderstood. We need a categorical approach in this situation because of, we need to give police officers something workable. You know, they're out on the field, they need to be able to have pretty clear-cut direction on how to pursue drunk driving cases, which is, unfortunately not abnormal to face regularly. So they also talk about how search warrants aren't practical. Their point is that North Dakota is a state where there's not, a ton of magistrates that are, there's a fair amount of drunk driving arrests. So in essence, that it would just put this undue burden on judges to have to add all these extra search warrants into their caseloads. So they said it's also practically unworkable. And the benefits that Justice Sotomayor is advocating is of a search warrant. The benefits of a search warrant in general is that, number one, you have a neutral magistrate judge to rule and weigh in on, you have an officer coming to a neutral magistrate judge for an objective opinion. And in their response to the majority opinion is that, drunk driving cases, the facts are pretty similar across the board. Slurred speech, bloodshot eyes, the, you know, walking unstably. So, and also a neutral magistrate judge who they're waking up at 2 in the morning versus the field officer, their point is that it really is hard for a neutral magistrate to, they're in a poor position to really challenge these types of characterizations. They're not there, and they're often not there for search warrants, but also here it's hard for them to, how bloodshot are their eyes? You know, how wobbly are they? It's just hard for them to really second guess those and challenge the assertions that they're making. So they said that benefit of that search warrant isn't really met by enforcing them. And then the second one that they said is a benefit of having search warrants that's not really met in this scenario is that a search warrant really limits the depth of intrusion. So, you know, in a normal house case, maybe it will say you can only search the closet, you can only come into the kitchen. Whereas here, you know, it's only breath. They already have that limit. It's already there. So, and that's obvious by a breath test. So that objective is already met as well. So the search warrant goals that Sotomayor is saying is so important, check and check, is what the majority is saying. But Justice Sotomayor, she gets her chance to write her opinion. So what she says is, again, it's under this premise that warrantless exceptions to the Fourth Amendment should be rare. They should be the rare carve-out. They're not something that we should be just chipping away at the Fourth Amendment bit by bit until it's no longer existent and you don't need warrants for anything. So she said that the question is not really whether the public interest justifies the type of search in question, but more specifically, whether the burden of obtaining a warrant is likely to frustrate the government purpose. So she looked at the burden. How much of a burden is it really to the people of, you know, a state like North Dakota to be able to enforce search warrants? And so she looked at 5 different aspects of this analysis. So first she says the government's interest in protecting the public from drunk drivers is already met. When you pull somebody over for drunk driving, they don't get to continue to drive just because you didn't take a breath test. So they're already pulled off the road once you identify that they're suspected of drunk driving. If they refuse to submit to the breath test, then doesn't mean they don't go back to the station. Like, they still go back to the station. So there's still that immediate threat to the public of somebody being drunk on the road is eliminated. So at that point, you know, the majority stress on this, you know, public interest concern, we got a safety to the public, that is met by the police officer pulling the person over and arresting them. So that does not mean that they shouldn't also have to do a search warrant. Then she addresses this concern about, being able to pull this. Normally search warrants, especially under exigency, the exception to that allows you to quickly get evidence, so there's not this prevention of the destruction of evidence. And she says, you know, the search warrant here is not going to add a lot of time. The part that I said I was going to come back to about the part that there's the preliminary road breath test, and then which is not admissible in court, or at least not at the time when this case was argued in 2016. They have to go back to the police station to do the breath test that is admissible in court. So she's saying you're already taking the 15-minute, the 20-minute drive, whatever it is, you're already doing that. So there's already this delay built into the process of getting these tests. So you can call a magistrate, and they had people write amicus briefs, and in Montana and Wyoming, I think, are the 2 states that who are similarly rural, they said they're able to get a search warrant in 15 minutes. And so they kept pressing the attorneys at oral argument to say, give us the on the facts, on the ground problems about why this is impractical and unworkable. You know, if states like Montana and Wyoming are able to do this in 15 minutes, North Dakota, you should be able to do that as well. There's also the part about the burden on, she wasn't too sympathetic to the fact that they were trying to say, you know, North Dakota is this state that we don't have as many judges. You know, there's some areas where they only have one police officer at a time. And so, in essence, we're going to have to hire more people and staff this more. And she said she doesn't agree with that it doesn't actually, there's not this huge cost aspect of it. So she looked at the statistics, and she said that, so if you take North Dakota, for example, so assuming, and again, this was in 2016, but assuming that no warrants are done with those statistics, you know, assuming no warrants are ever done in drunk driving cases, and then it switches to now search warrants are going to be in every drunk driving case. So assuming those two extremes as your starting point, she said that on average would increase the search warrant analysis for judges to be 2 times per week. So that's all the burden that you're adding, is an additional 2 search warrants for judges to assess per week. And she's like, that's not crazy. And that's the extreme, you know, that's the extreme where no search warrants are being done to search warrants in every single case. And then she said, if you look further, sometimes just the, I don't want to call it a threat, but like the discussion of, hey, we're going to have to, you know, while you're on the ground, you're talking to the person that you're suspected, who's suspected of driving under the influence, and you say, hey, we're going to have to get a warrant for this, so hang tight. A lot of times, she said that people voluntarily consent to the breath test anyways. There's a fair amount of voluntary consent going on already without, without requiring search warrants. And so when she looked at how many people are already voluntarily consenting to doing these types of tests, she said instead of it being 2 search warrants per week that was going to be added to the burden of each and every judge, it would only be 1. So she's like, I don't believe you to the majority about how burdensome this would actually be on judges. Because when she ran the numbers, again, in a state like North Dakota, she said it would really only add 1 extra search warrant a week. So there's a convenience argument, which is next. And that has a big X under that. In the sense that she says it doesn't matter if it's more convenient. That's not how this analysis should work. Mere convenience in gathering evidence does not justify an exception to the warrant. So that shouldn't be a consideration. Then the last one is compliance. So she said that this court has, in essence, there is a mechanism besides having this, you know, if the carrot and stick there's a criminal punishment coming your way if you don't comply. Because that oral argument, the state folks kept saying, we need this because if people can just refuse and then there's nothing we can do. We take their driver's license away, but some of our state statutes are structured in a way that are recidivist in nature. So if this is their second DWI, then they get an enhanced penalty. And so if we just punish them for, you know, refusal to take the test, we don't actually get the test results. That allows us to convict them for an enhanced, for the drunk driving, which doesn't allow them to enhance it. And she's like, you're asking me to write new laws. She's like, that's a problem that you need to talk to your state legislators about. We're not here to draft a new law because that's how your recidivist statutes work. That's not our problem. And she said, take that to your state. You still have a mechanism to impose criminal penalties, specifically criminal penalties, for people if you go through the warrant process. Again, she keeps advocating for a warrant. So she said if people do refuse to do the warrant, then you can punish them criminally for obstruction, and which is, again, it's not drunk driving. But that you can structure the laws for obstruction to be just as, forceful of a punishment as maybe what, drunk driving would be. But so she says that that a search warrant doesn't mean, by implementing a search warrant, that doesn't mean that you're taking away the state's ability to criminally prosecute anything, really. So So that's how she goes through why she feels that search warrants should be part of both blood and breath tests. It should be a, or stated differently, that there shouldn't be, we shouldn't budge here on a categorical break from warrants. There should be, it should still be assessed case by case and not a categorical exception. So, told you that Justice Thomas took the opposite of Judge Sotomayor, and Ginsburg joined Sotomayor, and he said he's kind of out on his own in the, like I said, in the exigency camp, and he says that, right, that this blood alcohol is diminishing as your body metabolizes it. That's sufficient. We should have a categorical carve-out for both blood and breath tests. The end. He's on his own island on that opinion. And then, so where do we land with our three individuals where we started the case with? So with Birchfield, that led to a reversal. So that he was our namesake for the case. He is the person who did submit to the preliminary breath test and then refused to submit to the blood draw later on. Blood draws are, they said, you're not allowed to have the law that says that that's criminal to refuse that. So he got that, his conviction got reversed. Bernard out of Minnesota didn't fare as well. Again, he was a breath test gentleman who failed to do the breath test. Supreme Court said we are allowing warrantless breath tests, so that conviction's affirmed. And then our last gentleman out of North Dakota, he was the one that did agree to the blood draw, but says that should be reversed because my consent was invalid. And so they remanded that, and they said, when you look at consent, that's something for the lower courts to assess under the totality of the circumstances, so we're not in the position to do that. So so that's going to be remanded for further exploration of the facts. So that is where the case, the Supreme Court case, ultimately lands. Like I said, this case came down in 2016, so a few minor updates since then, and I'm sure there's listeners that are listening right now that that DWI defense or even prosecution is their bread and butter. So if they're listening right now and you know have the more on the ground sort of updates on what's happened since Birchfield came out, then please write it in as you know to our live chat. But my understanding of what's happened since post-Birchfield is that the statute has been amended now, since obviously the Supreme Court found that the blood tests are criminal prosecution for it is for refusal. So that statute has been amended. They've also had cases where that has extended to urine tests. So, and then also that it applies retroactively, which is the disclaimer where if somebody's listening right now that has an old DWI that they want to challenge, speak to somebody else who does this kind of work. Because like I said, I mean, I live in the federal world where I don't do DWI stuff. But so when it applies retroactively, what that means is that people who had previously been convicted of having a DWI for the blood test specifically, they can, just like Mr. Birchfield did, they can go back and have that reversed. And potentially they can challenge that and say, and have their conviction vacated. And so that's my understanding of the post-Birchfield world in North Dakota. So that is the little journey down DWI in North Dakota and Minnesota and how that made it all the way up to the highest court in the land, and how they got to explore the ins and outs of North Dakota specifically. So, any questions?
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Yes.
Do we have any questions on the online chat?
There are two questions on the online chat. So, the first question is, does fear of COVID justify refusal to submit to breath test without a mask or other prophylactic?
Hmm. That's a good question. And again, I feel like there should be, DWI is not my world. It's, again, federal stuff, and DWIs are, live in the state world mostly. So I don't know the answer to that. I can give a 2-cent opinion for whatever that's worth, probably those 2 cents, which would be my understanding, which is very limited, of breath tests. I learned a lot through this opinion in general, is that, you know, they're blowing into it's very targeted what you're blowing into. It goes into a tube. Like, it's really directed into a specific box. You know, it's not like you're breathing out all over. I should say in front of the mic. It's not like you're breathing out and, you know, to the officer. And the officer's like, yeah, 0.27. It's, you know, so I don't know how much risk is really caused by having this straw mechanism. It seems like it would be limited inherently. But again, if there's folks that are listening on the live part that know these breathalyzer things, you know, the ins and outs of them, and, you know, disagree with my opinion, speak up. But I don't think COVID would really impact this too much.
And then the second question is, can a magistrate permit blood withdrawal at the nearest outhouse?
At the nearest outhouse was a twist to that question. Does that outhouse, that makes me think of a bathroom. Is that what that person?
That's what it says.
Okay. Outpost or, so my understanding of where they do the blood test specifically, so the breath test is where they, you know, they go back to the station. I know that part. And then they explain that blood tests, they're taken to a hospital. You know, it's like a very medical, you know, it's not like these officers are doing those kind of things in the back of the squad car. So maybe that was a typo on that person's part. But if it wasn't, about, I don't think anybody was ever doing anything at a, no, I don't think a magistrate judge would permit a test, a blood test at an outhouse. So, any live questions? No. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Yeah.
Welcome back. We are so excited to be concluding the day with this panel on the Ethics Commission.